to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the New York Times, from the Washington Post, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Don't forget that podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article published in the New York Times on January 21st. This article is entitled, "Was Dorothy Day Too Left-Wing to Be a Catholic Saint?" The subheadline, "The Archdiocese of New York has asked the Vatican to consider the social activist for sainthood, but church leaders are not entirely comfortable with her politics." This article is by Liam Stack of the New York Times. Hundreds of people gathered at St. Patrick's Cathedral to celebrate an important moment for Catholics in New York. Cardinal Timothy Dolan delivered a homily on the life of one of their own, Dorothy Day, a native New Yorker and anarchist writer and activist who died in 1980. The sermon last month represented the end of a 20-year inquiry by the Archdiocese of New York on whether Ms. Day should receive sainthood, a question the Vatican will ultimately decide. Many of her admirers, including her granddaughter, had hoped Cardinal Dolan would talk about her commitment to social justice for the poor and the oppressed, and her opposition to war and capitalism. In 1933, Ms. Day, often described as both politically radical and theologically orthodox, founded the Catholic Worker Movement, which remains active around the world in the form of Catholic worker houses, where members live for free and provide services to the poor. But in his sermon, Cardinal Dolan described Ms. Day's far-from-sinless life. "I am not going to go into her story," he told the audience. "The important thing for them to know was that when she was 25, she became kind of frustrated with her life. She had done quite a bit of experimenting and drifting, and she'd be the first to admit her promiscuity," the cardinal continued. "But she kept detecting an emptiness, a searching in her life. And after a lot of prayer and study, that led in 1925 to her baptism as a Catholic." His remarks skimmed over her push to change policies that affected the poor and her political beliefs, adding fuel to the long-standing anxiety among Catholic workers that the Catholic hierarchy may dilute or obscure her message even as it considers elevating her. After Mass, Martha Hennessy, Ms. Day's granddaughter, was distraught. "He has reduced her to, 'She lived a life of sexual promiscuity and she dabbled in communism,' she said. What worse enemy could we have saying those things about her?" Ms. Hennessy is active in the movement and did a reading at the Mass. "We've got to focus on her policies. We've got to focus on her practices." Ms. Day loved the church and its rituals and devoted her life to the gospel, which she felt drove her to renounce material possessions and commit herself to a life of activism on behalf of the poor, a devotion to pacifism in opposition to both capitalism and communism. She often described herself as an anarchist. "One thing about Dorothy Day that I love is that she makes everyone uncomfortable," said the Reverend Anthony Andreassi, the principal of Regis High School in Manhattan, who led a prayer service outside Ms. Day's childhood home in Brooklyn one day last month. "The Catholic Church, like everything else, is so divided between liberals and conservatives," he said. "She is one of these people who both the left and the right find so much richness in." Ms. Day was born in Brooklyn Heights in 1897 and grew up in a working-class family. Her parents were Protestants who rarely attended church, though even as a child she had an interest in spirituality and scripture. The family moved to Northern California and later Chicago for her father's job as a sports writer, and Ms. Day returned to New York as an adult. She spent much of her 20s writing for leftist newspapers in New York City and living a bohemian, bar-hopping life in Lower Manhattan. She dated writers and artists, including the communist author Mike Gold, became close with the playwright Eugene O'Neill, and later had an illegal abortion and attempted suicide. Ms. Day converted to Catholicism after the birth of her daughter, Tamar, whose baptism alienated Ms. Day from some of her activist friends. In 1932, a Catholic magazine sent her to cover the Hunger March in Washington, D.C., an effort to bring the Roman Catholic Church in the United States into the economic and social upheavals in the 1930s. It was also a response of sorts to communism, which offered a similar but militantly atheist critique of economic exploitation. That assignment inspired Ms. Day to begin a leftist newspaper, The Catholic Worker, which began selling in 1933 for one penny and has not raised its price since. With the help of the French theologian Peter Morin, she turned the newspaper into a full-fledged movement. Catholic workers, as members of the movement are known, commit themselves to lives of voluntary poverty, service to the poor and the oppressed, and peaceful activism on their behalf. The movement occupies a complicated position in the Catholic Church, whose American leadership has become increasingly aligned with political conservatism since Ms. Day's death. Cardinal Dolan himself is known as a conservative who delivered the opening prayer at the Republican National Convention in 2020. The Catholic worker movement is all about asking yourself, if Jesus were alive today, who would his disciples be? Said Bob Roberts, 61, a worker who gathered with others at the movement's house in the East Village on a recent winter morning. He assembled bologna sandwiches as members prepared to distribute food to the poor. Ms. Day would be the first New Yorker made a saint since the 19th century educator Elizabeth Ann Seton in 1975. The process of making Ms. Day a saint started in the late 1990s, when Cardinal John J. O'Connor of New York began collecting information from those who had known her. By 2002, the Archdiocese had begun its formal inquiry into her life. 10 years later, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops unanimously voted to support the inquiry. Its completion took nearly another decade, with the findings sent to the Vatican. The next step in the process would be for the Church to document two miracles that occurred thanks to Ms. Day's intervention, after which she would be named a saint. The Church prefers for miracles to have some medical component, a terminally ill patient who makes a full recovery, for example, because it is relatively straightforward to document the before and after effects, said George Horton, an organizer of the canonization effort. The process of identifying and verifying a miracle can take years, or it can happen quickly. Mr. Horton said the Archdiocese had already received a number of letters from people who say that their prayers to Ms. Day resulted in miraculous events in their lives. "We have some leads," he said. In the interest of privacy, he declined to provide details about any of the leads the church officials viewed as most promising. But what, Ms. Day's supporters have asked, is the cost of sainthood. They question whether Ms. Day would have even wanted the designation. "I think if she heard she was going to be a saint, her knees would buckle," said Carmen Trotta, who has lived in the Catholic worker house in the East Village since 1987 and occupies Ms. Day's old bedroom. Indeed, Ms. Day often reacted negatively when people praised her as saint-like. "Don't call me a saint," she said in one frequently cited quip. "I don't want to be dismissed that easily." Her admirers also do not want her to be so easily digestible. "If people hear about Dorothy Day from the Catholic hierarchy, they might get a misimpression of her," Mr. Trotta said. "She was a rare breed, a Catholic pacifist who didn't believe in war, a suffragist, a member of the Anti-Imperialist League." Ms. Hennessy, her granddaughter, cited other people whose lives had been flattened to a single, often whitewashed message. She said she shared the concerns of many others in the Catholic worker movement. "Their mistrust has some legitimacy to it in terms of, you know, how do we treat Martin Luther King Jr.," Ms. Hennessy said. "Are we really understanding the message he was trying to give us? And Mother Teresa, she got marginalized by becoming a patron saint against abortion when her whole life was about caring for the dying when nobody else would care for them. How did that get translated into anti-abortion?" Beyond her discomfort with being called a saint, Ms. Day, who eschewed materialism, expressed concern about the use of church money for things like canonization, which requires years of painstaking work. Indeed, the research process in her case has been expensive, costing an estimated $1 million, mostly because of the voluminous materials documenting Ms. Day's storied life as a rabble-rouser and a prolific writer. In addition to work at the Catholic Worker, she wrote books, personal diaries, correspondence, and even a short-lived lifestyle column for the Staten Island Advance newspaper. She was also arrested on several occasions for nonviolent protest, including once at the age of 75. Her activism and writing drew the attention of federal law enforcement, which maintained a file on her in the 1940s. Most of that expense has been accrued in the last 7 years, when the effort to spend $100,000 to $120,000 on average annually, Mr. Horton said. Much of that money has come from the Archdiocese of New York, he said, but it has also come from donors whom he declined to name. Mr. Horton said free labor was contributed by theologians and historians, church officials who interviewed Ms. Day's friends and relatives, and a team of more than 100 volunteers who read and transcribed her works. More than 200 people have worked on the effort, he said. "We have tried very much to emphasize her whole message, but sometimes it does get left out," he said. It has not been left out of the information that is going to Rome, I can tell you that. But far from being a paradox, he described the difference between Ms. Day's political radicalism and the politics of the church as a source of excitement and hope. "We call her a saint for our times because she gives us a way back to unity," Mr. Horton said. "She crosses all the divisions in our society and our government and our church, and she calls us back to the essence of the gospel. I think that is what is recognized by church leaders." Our next article this week on religion in the news comes from the Washington Post, dated January 22nd. This article is entitled, "Monks in New Mexico Desert Dedicated to Hospitality Reflect on 2 Years Without Guests." This article is by Chris Moody of the Washington Post, dateline Chama River Canyon, New Mexico. Hidden in this canyon of crimson sandstone cliffs encompassed by miles of federally protected wilderness, the Monastery of Christ in the Desert seems like an ideal place to ride out a pandemic. For more than 50 years, a small community of Benedictine monks has quietly lived, worked, and worshipped here in a cluster of off-grid adobe buildings along the banks of northern New Mexico's Chama River. Considered the most remote Catholic monastery in the hemisphere, it can be reached only by a 13-mile single-lane earthen road that winds through the canyon. Abiquiu, the closest village, population 151, is 25 miles away. Groves of cottonwood and willows line the river where bald eagles hunt for rainbow trout. Black bears, coyotes, and cougars prowl the pinon and sage-scented Santa Fe National Forest, which surrounds the monastery. Despite the difficult journey, outsiders have flocked to this serene abbey for decades in search of spiritual renewal. As adherents to the 6th century rule of St. Benedict, which teaches that monasteries are to treat visitors as they would Jesus himself, the monks graciously welcome outsiders. As many as 30,000 people make the pilgrimage each year, including past notables such as the artist Georgia O'Keeffe and the actor Matthew McConaughey. Guests are an integral part of Benedictine monastic life and have been for 1,500 years. Monasteries, St. Benedict wrote, are never without them. That was true for Christ in the Desert until March 2020, when the coronavirus pandemic forced the monks to close their doors to the outside world. For nearly 2 years now, guests have been prohibited from staying at the monastery, leaving the monks in a position they have never faced before. "Guests are part of who we are," said Brother Chrysostom, the monastery's bearded guest master, who joined the fellowship in 2017. "We can only go so long without guests, and not just for financial reasons, for identity reasons. Not having visitors would betray the whole Benedictine charism." The monks had little choice. Given their communal living arrangements, monastic communities are particularly vulnerable in a pandemic. 9 monks from the monastic community of Mount Athos in Greece have died of COVID-19. Last February, 2 nuns at the St. Walburg Monastery in Villa Hills, Kentucky, died after 28 sisters were infected with the coronavirus. Outbreaks occurred in monasteries worldwide, including in Italy, the Philippines, and Ukraine. With elderly brothers at Christ in the Desert, the oldest is 95, a coronavirus outbreak could have proved a death sentence. To protect themselves, the monks blocked the entrance with a gate. "Please do not enter our property," a prominent side pleaded. "We have high-risk individuals in our community." Some outsiders ignored their request. "People tried to storm the door and I'd say, 'No, you can't come in here,'" Brother Chrysostom said. "They just disregarded the gate and came in anyway. Some understood and some were very upset about it. It was just what we had to do. If one of us gets COVID, we all get it." It was a decision they did not make lightly. The guest houses and gift shop have traditionally served as the monastery's primary sources of income, a necessity to fulfill Benedict's order that monasteries be self-sustaining. In exchange for a donation ranging from $85 for individuals and $170 for couples, guests receive a simple room and 3 daily meals. They may attend services and mass in the chapel with the monks, explore the canyon, and if they wish, work alongside the brothers during their morning labor period. The monastery has 8 guest rooms available and can accommodate 13. Guests stay a minimum of 2 nights and can arrange visits lasting several weeks. Benedictine monasteries have always provided spaces for refuge, peace, and reflection, a reprieve from the stormy fellowship of human life, as St. Augustine put it. World-weary pilgrims have especially sought them out in times of collective national distress and hardship. After World War II, monasteries worldwide received an influx of applications. In the months after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, Christ in the Desert was flooded with guests seeking spiritual guidance. But in this present moment of collective trauma and loss, the monks have been restricted from providing such a haven, unable to fulfill a part of their divinely ordained mission. While the monastery was closed to guests for the first time since it was founded in 1964, the brothers turned inward. The community also shrank from almost 60 in 2019 to 23 today. One thing that has changed is that it has allowed us to consolidate and coalesce as a community. Without visitors, we just have ourselves, Brother Chrysostom said. We're less self-conscious about what we're doing, especially younger monks. It's so easy to get into a performance sometimes. The monastery keeps a tight schedule, and in that regard, life among the brothers changed very little while it was closed to guests. They still rose before dawn for vigils at 4 a.m. and returned throughout the day to chant the Psalter together inside the solar-powered adobe chapel. They attended Mass every morning and ate communal meals in silence. They worked on projects to sustain the community, focusing on weaving, cooking, laundry, and maintenance. And they prayed continually for those suffering from COVID-19, for the world, for God's grace in exceedingly trying times. The monks also responded to the pandemic in ways that feel relatable to those who have experienced it beyond the safety of the canyon. Brothers who made trips to town for supplies quarantined before re-entering the community. Before health officials brought life-saving vaccines in early 2021, the monks kept their distance from one another during services in the chapel and meals in the dining hall. For more than a year, some monks never left the canyon. Because of these measures, no one at Christ in the Desert has tested positive for the coronavirus. When Brother David quarantined as a precaution for 2 weeks in March 2021, he passed the time by painstakingly lining up 2,000 dominoes that wound through his room in a dazzling display of brightly colored labyrinthine loops, spirals, and patterns. He posted a video of his achievement on YouTube. "Being quarantined for 2 weeks has been wonderful," he wrote on his channel. "I could go on for a few more weeks if it was not for the fact I am unable to attend Mass." The isolation allowed the monks space to devote time to new projects. Since 2020, they have transformed their property through an ambitious agricultural program spearheaded by Abbot Christian Lacey, who was elected to the position in 2018. The monks acquired a herd of Navajo Churro sheep, goats, chickens, and a black and white donkey named Maddie who chases away predators. They continued to work on a 5-year program during the pandemic to develop gardens, livestock, pastures, and orchards on the land. They recently constructed a greenhouse to grow fresh food and vegetables. The isolation during the pandemic has provided the monks the opportunity to experiment in ways that would have been more difficult with guests, said Father Columba, a monk from Canada who is overseeing much of the monastery's agricultural endeavors. "It gave us the enclosure, to be honest, to develop unhindered," he said. "The donkey is very territorial. When we have guests, we won't be able to do what we've been doing. We'll have to enclose." The agriculture supplies have allowed the monks to become less reliant on trips to town for supplies. "We're not anywhere close to self-sufficient," Brother Chrysostom said. "We rely on Our Lady of Walmart and Costco." Unable to share their life and work in person, some of the monks created YouTube channels, which provide a glimpse of life behind the adobe. Brother David, who goes by the social media alias The Desert Monk, has showcased the brothers building a solar-powered irrigation system, cooking in the kitchen, installing an electric fence, harvesting Christmas trees, weaving wool in their shop, and raising a baby lamb named Shadow. On the monastery's official YouTube channel, Abbot Christian led a tour of spring flowers, introduced viewers to a new hen, Linda, and walked through the vegetable garden full of squash, lettuce, onions, pumpkins, cherry tomatoes, and kale. "Wish you were here," he laments on camera, standing next to a new chicken coop. "We all know why you're not." The entrepreneurial spirit is nothing new for the monastery. To support themselves financially, the monks have adopted creative income streams over the years. Until recently, they grew hops and sold monk's ale beer. In the mid-2000s, they played a starring role in a reality show on the Learning Channel. "Truly, it is a challenge to use television to spread the gospel," the abbot at the time remarked afterward, and they signed a record deal to make albums of their chanting. As early adopters of the internet in the mid-1990s, they built their own website and realized that they had a knack for web design. Using a modem connected to a mobile phone powered by solar panels, they started a business building websites that became an international media sensation. They consulted with the Vatican on the Holy See's website. At one point, the high level of traffic to their monastery site caused the entire internet in the state of New Mexico to crash. The enterprise was so successful, however, that they had to shut it down. Monks work only a few hours a day, and the website design business risked crowding out other spiritual disciplines. Without guests to care for, Brother Chrysostom, 57, has explored new pursuits. He writes the monastery newsletter, and he built an apiary to provide honey for the community. Years ago, the monastery's last attempt at beekeeping was thwarted by a bear that ransacked the hives. As a former academic with several advanced degrees, including from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Johns Hopkins, and the University of Pennsylvania, Brother Chrysostom spent the pandemic earning a certificate in hotel management from Cornell University, and he's pursuing an MFA in creative writing at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. As a musician who is part of a civic orchestra and a jazz trio in his past life, he occasionally retreats to a small adobe outbuilding where he stores a double upright bass and a keyboard to play in his free time. The walls are decorated with icons of St. Ruth, St. Mary Magdalene, and St. John Chrysostom, his namesake. A photo of jazz bassist Charles Mingus sits on a small table. Brother Chrysostom and his fellow monks are looking to 2022 as the year that normalcy returns. In late August, the monks began receiving day visitors. They plan to finally welcome back overnight guests at the end of February, nearly 2 years after the gates went up. Like much of the rest of the world, the pandemic, despite all its horror, gave the monks an opportunity to pause and reset. Guests who return may discover a different place from the monastic community they visited before the closure. I think that it's been a very good time for us, a restful time. It has been a chance for us to slow down and actually become acquainted with one another, Brother Chrysostom said. People will probably notice a different feel in the community as a result of it, a different direction. We'll turn next to an essay from the journal Religion and Politics, published on January 25th. This essay is by Jacob Lupfer, a writer in Jacksonville, Florida. And this essay is titled, Why the U.S. Presidency Demands Theological Universalism. The American presidency contains a number of puzzles concerning religion. The country is ever more diverse and secular, but many citizens still say they want the president to be a person of faith. Yet aside from any personal religious commitments, the president is a functionary in the country's robust civil religion, the set of national and official commemorations, rhetoric, and events that symbolize the nation. As opposed to parliamentary systems in which the head of government is elected locally and elevated by a party or coalition, the American president is head of state, head of government, and the leader of his or her political party, one of only two parties that must appeal as broadly as possible across religious lines. The presidency is a de facto universalist institution. It is not well suited to a strong sectarian or to anyone who holds exclusivist beliefs, even privately. A consideration of the unique aspects of the American presidency shows why successful candidates from across the Christian landscape have espoused a faith that is providential but universalistic and devoid of the kind of exclusivist doctrines and truth claims that are arguably foundational to Christianity. The Constitution forbids religious tests for public office, of course, but while parties are free to nominate and voters are free to elect a strong sectarian, it tends not to happen. Taken together, the constraints and demands imposed upon the presidential office essentially require that even strongly religious presidents translate their personal faith into universalist language. Most presidents have governed and politicked in this style, and surprisingly few have squelched deeply held sectarian beliefs in order to do so. The expression or even profession of highly exclusivist religious beliefs can quickly become problematic for federal officials. The Founding Fathers set the tone for subsequent presidential rhetoric about religion with a deeply providential outlook that was avowedly non-sectarian and not explicitly Christian. Washington and Jefferson championed religious liberty and tolerance, and also famously expounded views that were more deist or agnostic than Christian. Lincoln, who as an adult never joined any church, continued this tradition by speaking of the United States as under the guidance and judgment of divine providence, using Christian language and scripture without attaching specific Christian claims or beliefs. Presidents have often employed religious imagery, but more in service of rhetoric and symbolism than a specific wish for a Christian state. One example is Theodore Roosevelt, who ended his 1912 Republican convention speech with a rousing line, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord." But no one worried that Roosevelt had theocratic sympathies. It was simply was and remains common practice to employ religious imagery in political speech. And while each party had a religious base, with old-line Northern Protestants aligning with Republicans and Southern Protestants along with Northern urban and immigrant communities forming the Democratic coalition, neither party was incentivized to prioritize dogmatic religious beliefs. After World War II, religion was often seen as a unifying force, and ecumenical and interfaith impulses carried the day against fears of godless communism. Dwight Eisenhower typified this religious universalism in numerous comments, none more famous than a speech he gave after his election in 1952 at New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel, in which he said, "In other words, our form of government has no sense unless it is founded in a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is." Eisenhower was baptized and received into the membership of the National Presbyterian Church in Washington 10 days after his inauguration in 1953. The arrival of Jimmy Carter on the national scene brought attention to his evangelical faith, and the movement of conservative Southern Protestants from the Democratic Party was endlessly observed and discussed as the most consequential religious and political shift of a generation. Subsequently, reporters began scrutinizing presidential aspirants' religious beliefs. Some elements within the Republican coalition began actively expecting that the nominee be a person of strong outward faith. To bolster his relatively weak religious bona fides, Ronald Reagan found it useful in 1980 to say to a gathering of evangelical pastors in Texas, "You are not allowed to endorse me, but I endorse you." After Reagan, evangelicals regularly contested the GOP nomination, even as nominal mainline Protestants generally continued to be the quadrennial Republican standard bearer. George W. Bush was a slight exception, though Bush is still a typical mainline Protestant, in spite of a midlife conversion experience, personal acquaintance with the Reverend Billy Graham, and the fact that evangelicals were a significant part of his political coalition. Democrats, who had a more diverse party coalition, mostly did not face intense demands from primary voters or interest groups about their religious views, but they still generally had to prove they were religious enough. Following Jimmy Carter, all Democratic presidents have spoken of their religious convictions and how their faith informs their policies. Bill Clinton, a Southern Baptist, was comfortable speaking of faith and showed a familiarity with the Bible and the rhythms of church life. Barack Obama, an adult convert to Christianity, knew theologian Reinhold Niebuhr's work and typified a liberal Protestant approach to ethics and politics. President Joe Biden, a devout Roman Catholic, has not shied away from making his faith a part of his political persona. Our presidential system of government, along with our political culture and civil religion, have evolved to require a certain kind of universalism. With the country becoming ever more diverse and less religious, it may be that the only kind of religious believer who faces de facto disqualification from the presidential office is the strongest believer of all. We had to edit that essay a bit for time because we've reached the end of our time this week on Religion in the News. We thank you for tuning in today and hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc, and this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available at our website, ncreadingservice.org. We appreciate you listening, and we'll talk to you next time. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service. We'll be right back.